Today we're going to finish talking a bit about entropy, and then we're going to see some of what entropy means. So, you know, some operational interpretations of entropy, some things that you can do with quantum states in various kinds of ways where entropy plays a role. So these things that we'll look at will be quantum data compression, although first I'll have to introduce classical data compression. And actually, once we've done that, the quantum part will be not so hard. And then we'll talk about entanglement, concentration, and dilution. So these are some transformations that you can make on quantum states that tell you something about how you can process entanglement in quantum systems. And they have a lot to do also with the concept of entropy. But first, I just wanted to recap something that we talked about last time. And I got a little bit confused when we were doing a certain calculation. And I wanted to just kind of explain what was going on. So we wanted to show that this Hellstrom theorem that says that the best POVM that you can do to distinguish two quantum states in the sense of the total variation distance between the resulting probability distributions is exactly the trace distance between those quantum states. And so we showed that no measurement could do any better than this. And then we wanted to show that there was a measurement that did at least this well. That measurement is this Hellstrom measurement that I think you've seen before. The way that measurement works is that if you're trying to distinguish mixed states rho from sigma, you look at the difference between rho and sigma, and then you can write that as the difference between two positive semi-definite operators, P and Q, that have disjoint support. So you take the positive part of the difference, and you put that into P. You take the negative part of the difference, and you put that into Q. And then this defines the operators P and Q. And then the measurement that you perform will be, the outcome corresponding to rho will be the projection onto the support of P. So that's what we call pi sub P. And then E1 will be everything else. Okay, so pi sub p is the projection onto the positive part of rho minus sigma. You take rho minus sigma and you take the all the eigenspaces corresponding to non-negative eigenvalues, and that gives you this operator pi sub p. And then we just we had to do a quick calculation to show that when you took this quantity, that you get in fact the trace distance between rho and sigma, and somehow it wasn't coming out to be exactly that. And the reason was that for some reason I was computing the guessing probability and not the total variation distance, right? So what we wanted to compute was this quantity, the distance between the resulting probability distributions, and I wrote down the wrong thing. So what we want to do is we want to compute this, where the distributions P and Q are the distributions that we see if we measure this POVM on either rho or on sigma, right? So let's compute this quantity. So the total variation distance between P and Q is just, it's just the, it's the classical analog of this quantity. So this is a half the sum over I of the absolute value of P sub I minus Q sub I, right? So P sub I and Q sub I are these quantities. So this is just a half the sum over I, the absolute value of the trace of E sub I times rho minus sigma, where these E sub I's are pi sub p and the identity minus pi sub p, right? So this is a half, so we have the absolute value of the trace of pi sub p times rho minus sigma plus the absolute value of the trace of the identity minus pi sub p times rho minus sigma, right? Okay, but now rho minus sigma is just the same thing as P minus Q, right? So we can just plug in P minus Q. But now notice that pi sub P projects onto the support of P. So when we act here on rho minus sigma, the only thing that's going to be left is the P part, right? So this is going to be a half the absolute value of the trace of all that's going to be left here is P, right? Because this is the same thing as, this is certainly the same thing as P minus Q, but the only thing that's going to be left when we project out the P part is going to be P. So the trace of P. And similarly over here, this is just P minus Q, but the only thing that's going to be left when we project out the part orthogonal to P is going to be Q. So this is plus the trace of the absolute value of the trace of Q. I guess there's some minus sign in here, but that doesn't matter anyway, because we're taking the absolute value. Right? This is going to give us, because Q is the negative part, this is going to be the same thing as, a half the trace of the absolute value of p minus q, which is the same thing as rho minus sigma. Right? So this is the distance between rho and sigma. Is that all right? Okay, so sorry for the mix-up there. Okay, so the last thing that we did last time was to introduce this concept of the von Neumann entropy. So I talked first about the Shannon entropy. So the entropy in a the classical entropy entropy in a probability distribution is something that we write as h of p, which is minus the sum of pi log pi, and this is the log base 2 to give us the entropy in bits. And then we talked about the von Neumann entropy, which is the quantum analog of this. So this is the entropy in a quantum state, and it's just minus the trace of rho log rho. So again, this should be the base 2 log if we want to get the von Neumann entropy in bits. Okay, so this is the amount of entropy in a quantum state. So it's just the Shannon entropy of the eigenvalues of rho. Okay, so this is the Shannon entropy, and this is the von Neumann entropy. Okay, so now we want to understand some properties of this von Neumann entropy and see what it is that it tells us about a quantum state. Okay, so first of all, just some basic properties. So first of all, some of these properties, analogous properties, will hold for the Shannon entropy. So for example, what can we say about the range of values that the entropy can take? Well, it's going to be a non-negative quantity. These probabilities are all going to be numbers between 0 and 1. So when we take the log of a number between 0 and 1, we're going to get something negative, but we have this minus sign here. So this is just the average of a bunch of non-negative quantities, so it's going to be positive. And this is just the same thing, but for the eigenvalues. So the entropy of a quantum state is certainly a non-negative quantity. And how big can it be? So suppose I have a d-dimensional system. Either I have a probability distribution that can take d different values, or I have a quantum state that's a d-dimensional quantum state. What's the biggest that the entropy can be? How big can the entropy be? Log d, right. Right. So log d is the biggest the entropy can be. So that's what you get, for example, if you have, if we're talking about the case of a probability distribution, that's what you would get if you had a uniform distribution. So that's the distribution that has the most uncertainty in it. It's the distribution where you can guess the least about what will happen when you make when you observe a sample from that probability distribution. And the analogous thing for quantum states is the maximally mixed state. So the state that has density matrix 1 over d times the identity matrix, that's going to give us, that's the unique density matrix that has as its eigenvalues the uniform distribution, and so there we'll get log d. Okay, good. And now, in some sense, the entropy is maximal when the state is maximally mixed. So when does a state have zero entropy? Well, a state will have zero entropy exactly when the density matrix is pure. Right. So S of rho is zero if and only if rho is a pure state. Any pure state has no entropy. When I say that the entropy is a measure of the uncertainty in the quantum state, I mean, of course, if you were to measure a pure state in a bad basis, then you might have, if you measured it in some basis, you might have a lot of uncertainty in that probability distribution. But if you have a pure quantum state, then there's always some basis you could measure in, namely a basis that would include that state, where there would be no uncertainty about what outcome you would get. You would always get the same outcome. So that's the sense in which having no entropy means that there's no uncertainty in the quantum state. So it just means that what you have is a pure quantum state. So as I was just saying, the entropy is going to be log d if and only if rho is maximally mixed. So it's 1 over d times the d by d identity. In other words, that it's maximally mixed. You know, there are lots of other properties that entropy has. For example, if you have a pure quantum state, then the amount of entropy in the reduced density matrices will be the same. So if you have a bipartite density matrix and it's pure, then this means that the entropy of the reduced density matrix on system A has to be the same of the as the entropy of the reduced density matrix on system B. And you know, there are lots of other properties that entropy satisfies. Maybe I just won't you know, write these all down. You can look them up if you like. And you know, for example, in Nielsen and Chuang, there's a nice treatment of entropy and some of its properties. There are a lot of inequalities for the entropies on subsystems and things like this that are useful to know about. But maybe it's not helpful here for me to just kind of go through a list of them. But you know, you should be aware, I guess, that entropy has a lot of useful properties. And if you want to understand something about about the entropy in some specific situation, it may be useful to know that those inequalities and properties exist. Okay, but one thing that I want to mention about entropy now is that you can think about entropy also as a measure of the entanglement of some bipartite state, right? So if we have a bipartite quantum state, then depending on how much entropy there is in one of the reduced density matrices. Well, okay, so it doesn't matter which reduced density matrix we talk about for a pure quantum state, because the entropy of either of either the A part or the B part is the same. But you know, if we have a pure quantum state, then we can think about this entropy as some kind of measure of how entangled the state is. So entropy of a bipartite pure state. Well, you know, so it's for the reduced density matrices. So let me say it like this. So for a bipartite pure state, the entropy of either reduced density matrix, either because it's the same for both reduced density matrices, this is a measure of entanglement. Okay, so why do I say that? What's the reason for this? So this is going to start to give us some kind of operational meaning for the entropy, and that's the reason that maybe this is interesting. Okay, but why should we believe that this has something to do with the amount of entanglement in a quantum state? So let me just define this quantity. So I'm going to call E of psi, if I have some bipartite pure state psi AB, then this is going to be the entropy of the reduced density matrix. So it doesn't matter if, by this fact, it doesn't matter if I trace out over A or B, I get the same thing. And now I want to claim that this gives me some kind of measure of how entangled the two subsystems A and B are. So one thing that you can see is that the entanglement of a bipartite pure state psi is going to be zero if and only if the state is unentangled. In other words, psi is a product state. Right? So if you have a product state, then psi is if psi is a tensor product of a well-defined pure state for the two subsystems, then when you trace out one of the subsystems, what you're left is just a pure state on the remaining system. And when you have a pure state, then the entropy will be zero. Right? So that shows one direction of this. And you can think about why the other direction is true. So this is really an if and only if statement, that a state is a product state if and only if it has zero entanglement in the sense of the entropy of the reduced density matrix. Something else that you can see is, for example, if you take the entanglement, try to compute the entanglement of a Bell pair, so a maximally entangled state with one qubit for Alice and one qubit for Bob. So what am I going to get for that? How many bits of entropy will there be? Yeah, it should be one, right? If someone asks a question in a lecture and the answer is a number, the answer is almost always one. If it's not one, then the next most likely answer would be zero. But very, very rarely would it be anything other than that. So you're right in this case, it's one. Why is it one? Because if you look at the reduced density matrix of a maximally entangled state of with one qubit on either side, the reduced density matrix will be maximally mixed, right? So the reduced density matrix will be the maximally mixed state on a qubit, and so the entropy of a maximally mixed qubit is one, right? Because it's the log of two. So this is going to give us one. This tells us, well, if we have a pure state, we have we have no entanglement in this sense. If we have a maximally entangled state, then for one qubit, then we have one bit of entropy. So we can think about this as one bit of entanglement. We sometimes say that we have one e-bit between Alice and Bob. This is not just a kind of like hand-wavy sense in which somehow the amount of entanglement goes between 0 and 1 as we consider states that go between psi and beta 0, 0. There's kind of a stronger condition that we can give. So to say what that is, I want to mention this notion of what's called LOCC. So this stands for local operations and classical communication. So this is a framework that people think about when they talk about entanglement and how you can manipulate quantum states and transformations that preserve entanglement. So this framework of LOCC describes the class of operations you can do where, let's consider the bipartite case. So we have Alice and Bob. Alice and Bob can each do local quantum processing, which means they can do absolutely anything that's allowed by quantum mechanics. So in particular, they could make measurements. And when they get measurement outcomes, that's classical information, they could send that classical information back and forth. So Alice could make a measurement, learn something about her quantum state, send that classical information to Bob, then Bob could process things in some way, maybe make another measurement, send the outcome back to Alice, et cetera, and they could do this back and forth for as many rounds as they like. The only thing that they can't do is send quantum information back and forth, and they have no pre-shared entanglement, so they can't teleport. So the only thing that they have the ability to do is local processing and classical communication back and forth. So it should be clear that, whatever entanglement is, it's not something that we should be able to increase by just local operations and classical communication, right? Because somehow we're not sending anything quantum back and forth. So we shouldn't be able to create entanglement out of nothing by LOCC. We shouldn't be able to increase, we shouldn't be able to increase the entanglement. We can always decrease it, I guess, because we could have some entangled state and we could choose to just measure it in some basis and, the entanglement, could go away. But we can't increase entanglement by performing LOCC. So what can we say about this measure under LOCC operations? Well, if we look at the entanglement of, at how the entanglement evolves, if we do some local processing, some local unitary processing on a quantum state, so if we do U tensor V, so, some operation U for Alice and some operation V for Bob, so I guess I could write that like this, on some state, then this is going to not change the amount of entanglement in the state. So that's something that you can show. Okay, basically because the entanglement of psi of a state psi will only depend on the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrices. But if you just look at how the reduced density matrix evolves for this quantum state, we're just changing the basis for the reduced density matrices. But otherwise, we're not changing the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrices. And so this state, this doesn't make any sense. What I mean is the entanglement of psi. Right? So the amount of entanglement in the state is not affected if we do some local processing. And more generally, if we allow performing some measurements and communicating back and forth, the entanglement cannot increase under LOCC. Right? So E of psi is non-increasing under LOCC. So this is this is kind of another thing that a good entanglement measure should have. It should have this property that it doesn't increase if you do LOCC operations, and that's a property which is satisfied by this quantity of a pure quantum state. Okay, but there's something even more striking that sort of suggests that this quantity E of psi is not just a valid entanglement measure, but it's really the entanglement measure that you should use, at least for pure quantum states. The situation is much more complicated for mixed quantum states, and if you want to know about mixed state entanglement, there's a whole story that we don't have time to talk about here. But at least for bipartite pure states, in some sense, this is really the unique measure of entanglement that you should take. And that's because of the following thing. So if we use LOCC and we consider the case where we have many copies of an input state psi, so we can do asymptotics, which sort of simplifies the picture. So for large n, and then with some error that goes to zero, or you could say with fidelity that goes to one, if we use the fidelity as a measure of the distance between two quantum states, as we discussed last time, then you can do the following transformations. So suppose you have n copies of the state psi. Then what you could do is you could try to turn that into copies of a maximally entangled state, the state beta 0, 0, that's just like a, you could think of that as some kind of, canonical form of entanglement that you just want to, if you want to pick, some entangled state, well, one entangled state that has a nice form is just, this one that we've seen before and that you're familiar with. So a question you could ask is, suppose you want to take n copies of psi and you want to turn it into some number of copies of this state, beta 0, 0, how many copies could you turn it into? And it turns out that the answer is, and this is really the best you can do, if you have n copies of psi, you can turn it into a number of copies of beta 0, 0, which is n times the amount of entanglement in psi. Right? So you can turn this into beta 0, 0 tensor n times e of psi. Right? So you can do this, not necessarily perfectly, but you can do this with fidelity that approaches 1 as n goes to infinity. So E of psi you can think of as the rate at which you can convert the state psi into copies of this standard entangled state. Okay, so this is called entanglement concentration. So it's like, you have this state which could be only weakly entangled, so you can only get a little bit of entanglement out of it. You want to get, instead of having copies of this weakly entangled state, you want to get copies of some maximally entangled state. And you can do that. In general, you will get fewer copies of the maximally entangled state if the state is only weakly entangled. And the rate at which you can extract maximal entanglement from the state that was originally given to you is precisely this entropic quantity. It's the entanglement of the state, which is just the entropy of the reduced density matrix. And the thing that suggests that this is really a unique measure of entanglement is that you can go in the other direction. So you can take, you could ask, suppose I have copies of a maximally entangled state and I want to make copies of psi, again using only LOCC, just using local operations and classical communication. What's the rate at which you can do that? Well, the rate is exactly the inverse of the rate to do this. Or in other words, if you have a number of copies of beta 0, 0, which is, n times the entanglement in psi, then you can turn that into n copies of the state psi. And this is called entanglement dilution. So now the idea is that you have many copies of a maximally entangled state, and you want to make some state that's more weakly entangled. You want to dilute the entanglement among, in general, a larger number of copies of some arbitrary state. And if that state has less entanglement, you can get more copies of it. And the rate at which you can do the transformation is exactly, 1 over the entanglement. In other words, if you have, n times e of psi copies of this thing, you can get n copies of this thing. Yes? No, psi could be here a state of any number of qubits. It should be a bipartite state for this whole setup to make sense. But it could be that this is a d-dimensional state for Alice and a d-dimensional state for Bob, let's say. And the number of copies of this thing you would get out would be again given by this.
So how then do you define the entanglement? Because if you have, you could have psi be 20 bell pairs, and if you split it up wrong,
There has to be a splitting, which is given to you, right? So if this is some bipartite state of some higher dimensional systems, it has to be clear what's the Alice part and what's the Bob part. So we could say it's a d-dimensional state for Alice tensored with some d-dimensional state for Bob, or that's the state space that they have.
So local here means we split it into two parts, and we're free to do whatever unitary on each section.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So in these asymptotic transformations, it's not like, okay, so let's consider the case where, psi is a state of a qubit for Alice and a state of a qubit for Bob, right? So then the state that they have here is n copies of that, but they're not restricted to act separately on the qubits. Alice will be able to act collectively on all of her n halves of the of the n copies of psi, right? And it will be necessary to do that in order to be able to do this transformation. Otherwise, you couldn't take advantage of the asymptotics, really. Yeah.
But if Alice and Bob each have a deep-dimensional system, is the maximally entangled state also a deep-dimensional system, or is it?
Well, I mean, I guess you could define some analog of things where you were computing the entropy in dits, and you know, then maybe you would do this thing in terms of dits. But I mean, for this statement, what I have in mind is that this state is really this. But it could be that psi is a d-dimensional system for Alice and a d-dimensional system for Bob. But you know, let's say, so for example, it could be that psi is, it's a four-dimensional. Alice has a four-dimensional space, and Bob has a four-dimensional space, and what they actually have is two maximally entangled states, right? So then the amount of entanglement in that would be two, because they have two e-bits. And then, you know, of course, the number of Bell pairs that they could get out would be two times n, because, you know, I mean, it's okay if beta 0,0 is a qubit state for Alice and a qubit state for Bob, and you can consider the situation where psi is not necessarily, a qubit for Alice and a qubit for Bob, and the fact that there's maybe more entanglement is just taken account, of by the fact that this entanglement could be larger if they've got some higher dimensional system. Yeah.
Is that the same as entanglement distillation?
Yeah. So usually the phrase, I mean, this is just a historical thing, but I think usually distillation is used for the mixed state case. So you could talk about the same kind of situation where this was not necessarily a pure state, but you had a mixed state, and then you could ask how many pure maximally entangled states could you get out, and you could talk about analogous kinds of transformations. And the situation is more complicated because things are not reversible in general. There's this notion of what's called bound entanglement, and it gets kind of complicated. And I think that phrase of entanglement distillation is usually used for that mixed state case. I think then it's called usually entanglement purification and entanglement distillation. It's just terminology. Okay, questions? Okay, so we're going to come back to this later. I just wanted to describe what this process is. Well, what we're going to do now is we're going to talk about, how we understand these operational interpretations of the entropy. So I want to talk about first entanglement, compression, data compression, and how the entanglement relates to that. Sorry, how the entropy relates to that. And then we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more about entanglement concentration and dilution, and we'll understand, sort of why this is true. But for now, I just wanted to mention, that it's true, and that this will give us an operational interpretation of the entropy in terms of a measure of entanglement of a bipartite pure quantum state. Okay. All right. Any other questions right now? Okay, so now we're going to talk about data compression. And in order to do this, in order for this to make sense, we first have to talk about classical data compression, because I imagine, well, I don't know, how many of you have seen like the details of Shannon's noiseless coding theorem before? So, compressing classical information. Have you seen this before? Only one of you, or two of you. One that's willing to raise her hand. Okay. All right. So, so I want to, give you at least a rough idea of how this idea of data compression works. So this is, this is really like the theory that's underlying, for example, when you compress a file on your computer and you send it to someone, how is that working? Well, that's basically what we're going to talk about. And if we understand how that works for classical data, it's actually not going to be too much of a leap to understand how it works for quantum states. So the compression of quantum states is actually a fairly minor extension of this idea of compressing classical data. Okay. Okay. So this is something that was worked out in a very influential paper that was written by Claude Shannon in the 1940s. It kind of got this whole area of information theory started, and really showed the significance of the entropy, the Shannon entropy. And in that paper he talked not just about data compression, but also the problem of sending information over noisy channels. But here we're going to just talk about data compression. Okay. So the idea we want to think about is as follows. So suppose two people want to communicate. Let's say Alice wants to send messages to Bob, and they have a noiseless channel, so they can just send messages, without having to worry about any noise being applied to the message. But they would like to use the message as the channel as efficiently as possible. Okay, so they don't want to, use any more uses of the channel than they have to. You know, maybe Alice is calling up Bob, you know, over a very expensive communications channel, and so they want to really have their conversation be as short as possible, yet reliably communicate all of the things that they would like to convey. And so it turns out that if you have a message where there's some redundancy in the message, I mean, you would expect that you should be able to, you know, by some means, get by with fewer messages than you would need otherwise. And the thing that quantifies this is exactly the Shannon entropy. So let's look at an example. We'll kind of show what's going on. So suppose we have four messages that we would like to you know, be able to send one of four possible messages, A, B, C, and D. But the different characters that we might send will not all be equally likely. Some of them will be more likely to occur than others. So let's say we have, you know, the message could be A, but that'll occur half the time. So this happens with probability a half. We might send the symbol B, but that happens with probability a quarter. Or we might send C, that happens with probability an eighth. Or we might send the signal D, and that happens again with probability 1/8. Okay, so we have a source, and it's, you know, it's outputting some text over this alphabet A, B, C, and D, and you know, some of the characters are more likely than others. So we could, of course, just send the message in the clear, just using, you know, four possible, just using each of these possible symbols as the things that we send over the channel. But that would be potentially wasteful because, you know, we're going to be saying A a lot more than we'll be saying C or D. So we would like to somehow take advantage of that redundancy, right? So if we send this unencoded, how many bits do we need for every you know, character of the message that we send? Well, we need to send 2 bits, right? So we need, there are four possible messages, so we would need the log base 2 of 4, which is 2 bits per symbol. All right, so we'd like to somehow do better than that. And so what we could do is the following encoding. So we're going to have some kind of encoding of these messages into bit strings, and we're actually going to use bit strings of different length for the different messages, right? So we would like to use shorter strings for the more likely messages. So here's an encoding that we could use. Let's say we encode A, and A is a 0, and then we encode B as 1, 0. Now, I mean, notice that when we're encoding into strings of different length, we have to be a little bit careful because we want it to be that the message can be unambiguously decoded, right? So it has to be clear somehow when we see the signal, you know, which piece of the message corresponds to a unit of the message, right? So here the idea is going to be that once we see a 0, we know that we're done, right? So if we just see a 0, we know that's an A, and we can start, you know, receiving the next symbol. But here, if we see a 1, we know something else is still coming. But if the next thing that we see is a 0, okay, then we know we're done, right? So that finishes that bit of the message. And then we can encode C into 1, 1, 0. Okay, so now again, we see a 1, then we know we have to wait. We see another 1, okay, we know we're still not done. We have to wait. And then once we see the 0, we know that what we've received has just been a C. And then we could encode D into 1, 1, 1. And now, you know, the idea is that, well, if we see 3 ones in a row, then we also are going to know that that's an entire symbol, and then we should stop, and we should start, you know, interpreting the next few things that we see as the, you know, the next incoming symbol. Okay. So what I can do if I have some, you know, long word over this alphabet A, B, C, D, I can just apply this encoding. I send A to 0, B to 1, 0, et cetera. And if I receive a stream of zeros and ones, I can uniquely decode the message from that string, just because of, you know, this property that I've set things up so that you know, there's just a simple way to encode this, to take the symbols one at a time and figure out you know, which characters have been sent. All right, good. But now the question is, you know, how many bits is this going to take? Right. So if we've got some message which has these statistics for the letters, how many bits am I going to need to do the encoding? Well, you know, what we can do is we can just calculate the expected number of bits, right? So what's the expected number of bits that it takes to you know, encode some message over this alphabet you know, if I have these statistics for the individual symbols. Well, let's you know, write down the expected number of bits that we need for just encoding one symbol over this alphabet. And then, of course, if we have n symbols over this alphabet, the expectation will just be n times that. So the expected number of bits for one symbol, which will be the rate of this encoding, will be the following. So with probability of half, I see an A. And if I see an A, I only need one bit to encode it. Right, so I have a half times 1. Now with probability of quarter, I see the symbol B. And if I have a B, now I need 2 bits to encode that. And if I see a C, I need 3 bits. So that happens with probability in n8. And if I have a D, I need 3 bits. And that happens also with probability in n8. Right? So this is the expected number of bits that I need to encode my message. And what is this? The answer, if you calculate this up, is 7/4. Right? So this is the number of bits that I have in each of these cases, and I just add them up with the associated probabilities. But now, the thing to observe is that this is less than 2, right? So, you know, if I did things in the naive way, then I would need to send 2 bits in order to convey every symbol of this message. But now in expectation, I only need 7/4 7/4 bits, and that's something which is fewer than 2 bits, and so I'm saving if I do this kind of encoding. And the other thing to see is that, how does this compare to the entropy of this source, the Shannon entropy of this source, right? The Shannon entropy is the expected log of 1 over the probability, right? So the Shannon entropy, what is that? Well, it's a half times the log of 2 plus, a half times times the log of 2. A quarter times the log of 4 plus an eighth times the log of 8 plus an eighth times the log of 8. Right? Or in other words, it's just exactly the same thing, right? Because the numbers I wrote here were the number of bits that I needed, but that was just, as it turned out, the log of 1 over the probability. I mean, with this particular encoding that I had, it turned out that this was the Shannon entropy I got by this encoding. Right? So this is exactly also 7/4. So it turns out that, you know, for this particular example at least, there's some way of encoding things. Actually, in this case, we don't need to really do asymptotics. Already at the level of how we would encode one symbol at a time, we can see that there's a simple encoding such that the expected number of bits per symbol is just exactly the Shannon entropy of the source. But what we see here is that there is some encoding which will allow us to encode at a rate that's given by the Shannon entropy of the source. And it turns out that this is actually the best you can ever do. So you can see that it's not possible to code at a rate that's higher than the Shannon entropy. I'll say a few more details about that as we go on. And it also turns out that you can always achieve that, right? So, you know, things didn't have to be this nice. This probability could have been a little bit bigger than a half. And, you know, I mean, these probabilities didn't have to be 1 over powers of 2. And, you know, it could have been messier. But it turns out that you can always achieve this. Whatever this value is for the Shannon entropy, it turns out that you can always achieve that. It just might be that you might need a more complicated encoding, and you might need to go into this asymptotic setting where you encode, things not just one symbol of the message at a time, but you have some block encoding where you look at many symbols of the message, and you have some kind of collective thing that looks at all of them at once in order to figure out how to encode them. Okay. So I guess that's the next point I wanted to make. So to make things nice in general, we consider block encodings. Which just means it will encode many symbols at once. But so the picture that we'll have is that, you know, we're going to imagine that we want to send messages. They come from some source which has some particular statistics for the individual symbols. To keep things simple, we'll imagine that it's an IID source. So the symbols will be identically distributed, and they'll be distributed independently for each of the symbols of the message. And now what we'd like to do is we'd like to take such an IID source and we'd like to encode it in a more efficient way than just encoding it in the clear. Okay, so I'd like to explain, you know, why it's the case that you can always encode at this rate and why you can't, and sort of, you know, motivate at least why you can't encode at a higher rate. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to, as I said, assume the source is IID. So the symbols occur independently and they're identically distributed. And you know, just again to keep things simple, but this is more or less without loss of generality, let's assume that the source outputs bits, right? So here we had an example where the alphabet had four symbols just to make things kind of interesting. But let's imagine that the source is really just outputting bits, and then we have some probabilities for 0 and 1. Okay, so the source outputs bits, and we're going to have 0 with probability p and 1 with probability 1 minus p. Right, so that's the description of the statistics of the source that we would like to compress. Right? Okay, but now we're going to consider block encodings. So we're going to take many symbols from this source before we decide how to encode them. So we're going to take, let's say, n symbols at a time, and we want to understand what the probability distribution looks like for those strings of n symbols. Okay, so if we have n samples from this distribution, what can we say about the probability of seeing some particular string? So let's look at the probability of seeing the string x1, x2, et cetera, through xn. Well, we can understand what that probability is just in terms of the Hamming weight, just in terms of the number of ones and the number of zeros, right? So let's say that alpha is the fraction of ones. Let's say that alpha is the fraction of zeros. So in other words, that there are alpha times n zeros. So alpha is the fraction of zeros. The probability that we see any particular string x1 through xn that has this property that there are alpha times n zeros is just going to be, it's going to be p to the power of alpha times n, because that's how many zeros we have. And the probability that we saw a 0 was p. And the probability that we see a 1 is 1 minus p. So we're going to have 1 minus p to the 1 minus alpha n. Right? So that's just the probability, just, you know, from the binomial distribution, that we see any particular string that has this property, that there are alpha times n zeros. Okay. So now what would we expect, right? I mean, so if the probability is p, what sorts of values do we expect to see for alpha? I mean, we could see any value, because it could be that p is, you know, it could be that p is 0.99, but nevertheless, there's some probability for any n that we happen to see a string of all zeros. It could happen, but it's not very likely, right? So what are sort of the typical values of alpha? What would you expect alpha to be? P, right, exactly. So like in the binomial distribution, you know, the expected number, it's not the Hamming weight, but it's, you know, n minus the Hamming weight. The expected number of zeros that we see when we take a sample and we have a probability p for 0 is that we would expect alpha, you know, we would expect alpha to be about p, right? So typically, alpha is around p. So what we're going to do is we're going to say that x1 through xn is a typical sequence. So this is going to be something we're going to define more precisely later. But we'll say that x1 through xn is a typical sequence if its value of alpha, so in other words, its fraction of zeros, is close to p. Okay, so we say that x1 through xn is a typical sequence if its fraction of zeros is close to p. That'll be what we mean by a typical sequence. Okay, so now what can we say about the probability of a sequence, you know, of getting some particular typical sequence? So the probability of seeing a particular typical sequence is just given by this expression where alpha is p, or it'll be close to that value, right? Typical just means that the fraction of zeros is close to this value. But you know, we're waving our hands a little bit now. But I mean, if alpha is close to p, then the probability that we see that particular string will be given by something close to this value with alpha replaced by p, right? So p to the p times n times 1 minus p to the 1 minus p times n. Right? That's like roughly speaking the probability of any particular typical sequence. Okay, so. So now what we can do is we can sort of take the log of this, and we'll see that that's related to the binary, that's related to the entropy in a nice way, right? So the log of this, we want to take log base 2 of this expression. So that's going to give us, well, just use properties of the log. So this is p times n times the log of p plus 1 minus p times n times the log of 1 minus p. Right? So that's the log of this probability. That's something which you might expect to appear in an entropy. And in fact, this thing is equal to minus n times something that's called the binary entropy of p. Right? So h2 of p is just the probability, is just the entropy of a distribution that has probabilities p and 1 minus p. So h2 of p is just minus p log p minus 1 minus p log 1 minus p. Right? And what we have here, this expression that we have here, I mean, now we're sort of justifying why the entropy was the right thing to write down. Right? If we look at the log of the probability for some typical sequence, what we get is about, minus n times the entropy of the associated probability p. All right, good. So now what can we say about the probability of any particular typical sequence, right? So the probability of this particular typical sequence it's just given by this kind of, complicated expression. But now we have some way of writing it in terms of the entropy. When we took the log of this, we got this. So the probability of a particular typical sequence is something that goes like about 2 to the minus n times the binary entropy of p. Right? So this is the probability of seeing any particular typical sequence approximately. Okay. But so now what can we say about the number of typical sequences, right? We know that each of them has a probability that goes like 1 over 2 to the n times h2 of p. Right? So that means that the number of typical sequences can't be any bigger than about 2 to the n times h2 of p. Right? Because if they were all equally likely, then that would be the most of them that there could be. If they all have probabilities which is close to this, then what we would expect is that the number of them is like 2 to the, is just like 1 over this. If the situation were like that we had a uniform distribution over all of the typical sequences, which is a pretty good approximation, actually, to the situation that we have, then 1 over this would be the number of typical sequences. Right? So the number of typical sequences is about 2 to the n times h2 of p. OK. So now how many bits does it take if I want to specify which typical sequence happened? So say I sampled n times from this distribution, and most sequences that are likely to happen are typical. So let's sort of just at first think about the case where that happens. Suppose we happen to see a typical sequence. Now, how many bits do I need to specify which typical sequence I had? Right? I could just write down what the typical sequence was, and that would take n bits. But if I'm promised that the sequence was typical, and I know that this is how many typical sequences there are, how many bits do I need to specify which one I saw? N times the binary entropy, right? If I have a number of messages which is m, then log m is how many bits I need to specify which message happened, right? So, so we can specify a typical sequence with n times h2 of p bits. Right? If that's how many there are, the log of that is, well, or this is, you know, about how many bits we need. We're being a little bit hand-wavy in all of this. Okay. So now this would suggest that, you know, h2, so in other words, the entropy of this distribution, h2 of p, is, you know, ought to be like the rate for encoding. But this is only the case if we only encode the typical sequences, right? And, you know, the probability might be small that we get an atypical sequence, but we also have to maybe worry about what we do in that case, right? So so how could we handle the case where we get a non-typical sequence, an atypical sequence? Well, there are sort of two things you could do. You could just, first of all, say, well, the atypical sequences are going to be really unlikely, so I'll just blow up my communications channel in that case, and it's very unlikely to happen, so I won't have to really worry about it. So if the probability is really small, just don't worry. Or another thing you could do is you could say, well, you know, if I happen to see an atypical sequence, I'll have some flag that I can set that'll say, okay, this is an atypical sequence, and then I'll just send the whole sequence. And that's going to take a lot of communication, but it's almost never going to happen. So if you just worry about what the expected amount of communication that you need is, you won't actually, you know, it'll still be small. The contribution from the atypical sequences will just be basically negligible, right? So so what we can do is, you know, either ignore atypical sequences because they're unlikely, or encode atypical sequences in the clear, you know, unencoded, encode them trivially, and then this won't increase the expected communication by much. All right, so this is all extremely hand-wavy so far, right? Because I just said, you know, like the probability is going to be close to this for something that's typical. I didn't say exactly what typical means, and then I said, you know, hopefully these other things will be small. So you have to, you know, you have to be a little bit more careful if you want to make all of this more rigorous. You know, I'm not going to prove anything carefully here, but I at least want to say, you know, what are the sort of definitions that you would use in order to make this more rigorous? So to make this more precise, what we're going to do is we're going to call a sequence epsilon typical if, epsilon is going to be something that quantifies the distance away from typicality. So let's say we'll call a sequence epsilon typical if its probability in the distribution that we get from our source, if its probability is between 2 to the minus n times the h2 of p plus epsilon, so, you know, something which is close to the true value but not away by too much, and 2 to the minus n times the binary entropy minus epsilon. Right? So if it doesn't, if its probability doesn't deviate by too much from the value for that we sort of expected to have in this argument above, then we'll call that sequence epsilon typical, and epsilon quantifies the deviation. And then what you can do is you can prove the following. Okay, so for any positive epsilon and delta, and for large enough n, all of this stuff is going to rely on this idea of block encoding, that we're going to do asymptotics, and we're going to take many symbols at a time. So first of all, what's the probability that a sequence is epsilon typical? Well, it's going to be at least 1 minus delta. So, you know, for any epsilon that we pick, and actually also for any delta that we pick, the probability that we see an epsilon typical sequence is at least 1 minus delta, right? So in other words, what this is saying is just that for any fixed epsilon, as you increase n, you know, the probability that a sequence is epsilon typical is going to be tending to 1. So basically, you know, almost all the time you're going to see an epsilon typical sequence. And then what can you say about the number of epsilon typical sequences, right? The other thing that we need for this to work out is that the number of epsilon typical sequences is, you know, is truly close to 2 to the n times the binary entropy of P. Of the distribution P. So what you can show is the following, that 1 minus delta to the 2 to the n times h of p minus epsilon is less than or equal to the number of epsilon typical sequences, which is at most 2 to the n times the h2 of p plus epsilon. Right? So if we just focus on the epsilon typical sequences, the probability that that happens will be tending to 1, and the number of them really will be close to this value that we saw here. So the number of bits that it takes to describe them will really be something which is close to the binary entropy of P. Okay? All right. So now, to really show that that this describes the best possible rate of communication, you would need to come up with some encoding that would allow you to describe these signals, and you would need to kind of take care of the case where where you deal with these atypical sequences. And if you do all of that, what you can prove is the following. So we just need another definition in order to state what happens. So we're going to call a compression scheme reliable. So a compression scheme would be some way, it would be an encoding. It would be some way of representing one of these sequences of n bits in terms of some shorter sequence. So we're going to, not all strings can be sent to shorter strings, right? I mean, the atypical sequences will actually be sent to longer strings, but they'll be unlikely to happen. So such a scheme will be called reliable if, the probability of correct transmission tends to 1 as n goes to infinity. We could potentially do the thing where we just ignore atypical sequences, and then, a way a scheme could fail to be reliable could be that, we just choose not to encode some messages correctly. Or we could do the thing where actually, it'll always be reliable because we'll just use really long strings for the atypical sequences. So we'll call a scheme reliable if the probability of correct transmission tends to 1. As n goes to infinity. And then we're going to define the rate of a scheme. We say the rate of the scheme is r if it compresses n bits into n times r bits. So the rate of a scheme is r if it encodes n bits into n times r bits. Right? So like the rate would be a half if you managed to send only half as many bits as you actually had in the original message. OK. So then what Shannon proved in this paper in 1948 is what's now called Shannon's noiseless coding theorem. And there are two parts of this. It says that you can encode it at a rate which is given by the entropy, and also that you can't do any better. Right? So if you try to encode at a rate which is no bigger than the entropy of the source. So here, let me just write h of p, and not even, so this could just be some distribution p over any number of symbols. It's not necessarily the binary entropy of one of these binary sources. So in general, if you try to encode at a rate that's less than the entropy, then there will exist a reliable scheme, right? So then there exists a reliable scheme of radar. And there's also a converse of this statement that says that if you try to encode at too high a rate, then no scheme will be reliable, right? So you could try to encode at a higher rate, and maybe you even allow the possibility that some transmissions will be wrong, but that fraction has to go to 0 as n goes to infinity. But even if you allow for that, it's not possible to encode at a rate that's higher than the entropy. So if r is bigger than h of p, then no scheme of radar is reliable. So, to actually prove this takes a little bit more work, but at least you have, kind of all the definitions that would go into showing this. And, this is something which is also discussed, for example, in Nielsen and Chuang, if you want to understand the details, of how you would actually prove such a coding theorem. OK, so what we'll do next time is we'll talk about Schumacher compression, which is the analogous thing for compression of quantum states. So if you've got a quantum source that's described by some reduced density matrix rho, then there'll be a very analogous thing that holds where, you know, instead of the entropy of some probability distribution, what we'll have is the von Neumann entropy of the quantum state, which after all is just the Shannon entropy of the eigenvalues of that source. So we'd like to see that we could do an analogous kind of compression on quantum states, and then that will tell us that the Shannon entropy is exactly a measure of how compressible a quantum state is. So if you have a source that's described by a density matrix rho, the number of qubits that you can compress that down into will be given exactly by the von Neumann entropy, at least in this kind of asymptotic regime where you take many copies of the state at once and encode them in some block fashion. Yes? You mean did I get something backward or?
We should always be able to encode 10 bits into 20 bits. The power is bigger than.
Right. So you should always be able to have did I get it backwards? Yes. It's even right in my notes. I just wrote it backwards. That's right. I mean, you should always be able to encode at a very high rate, you know, where you're just using many more bits than you need. But you can't, for example, if you try to encode at rate zero, that means you're sending no information. That should never be possible if you have a non-trivial message. Yeah, sorry, I just wrote the inequalities down. Other questions? Okay, so let's stop there. Next time we'll start to talk about quantum compression, and also we'll see how entanglement concentration and dilution kind of you can understand using the same sorts of ideas.